So here someone has left a page marked in Buddhist symbols in Tibetan culture for our friend with a question about the symbol of the endless knot. This was in one of the reading areas. And here is a couple of a page on that. Unfortunately, he's no longer here. So, the intertwining of the lines reminds us of how all phenomena are intertwined and dependent on causes and conditions. So I like that. But the best is one taste of samsara and nirvana. I've never seen that in as a description of it, but that's what it means to me right now. What is the difference between observing the mind in movement and mind in appearances? Aren't movements appearances? They are, but what we are doing, so you'll get the answer probably tomorrow morning. We have a full day tomorrow. but the mind in movement actually is the meditation basically is very similar to the mind in looking at the mind in stillness. So what we're doing, actually what we're really focusing on there is what is the nature of the mind in movement? And then the big question that we're going to be examining is the nature of the mind in movement different than the nature of the mind in stillness? And then the appearances, there are different approaches and a little more fuller, I guess, different ways of examining. But what Trungpa Rinpoche said, what is still the most important about that, examining the mind or looking at the mind in appearances, is still what it says about the mind rather than about the appearances. But all of it is about the nature of the mind. You know, so that's the most important thing, because when we find the nature of the mind, then what we basically, there's no reason to go through all the arduous work of trying to do the analyses of the emptiness of phenomena. Could you speak a little about afflictive doubt? Yeah, so this is one of the five obscurations. And so this is what can prevent us from, is an obscuration, preventing us from seeing what is already there. The natural, so the obscurations are obscuring the state of shamatha, the state of the mind in shamatha, which is the natural luminosity, non-conceptuality, and bliss of the mind settled in its natural state. And so afflictive doubt is one of those obscurations, and it is, so I think of it as being at a desert crossroads, and you know that, so you've come up one direction at a crossroads and you have three choices ahead. And you know that down each path lies water. but you just can't decide which way to go. So they find your bleach bones there at the crossroads. that's the way it, I think, can feel like if you are afflicted by this kind of doubt. So what it is not is it is not skepticism, because skepticism is a very healthy part of Buddhist practice. And Lama Allen wrote a book called Confessions of a Buddhist Skeptic. Isn't that it? Confessions, I think, yeah. And and the Buddha, you know, very famously said that don't take any of these teachings on faith, but you have to apply them and test them and come to the truth, if there is truth in them, for yourself. So just as a person who is buying gold in the market of India would not, just because something has a shiny surface or is colored gold, would not buy it without burning it, cutting it, rubbing it, basically assaying it to see whether this is real gold or not. And you're not going to take the seller's word for it. Not in India, not in Nepal. So, or Thailand, or Burma. So you have to do the testing yourself, and you bring a healthy skepticism to that. So the afflictive doubt then is when Lama Allen describes this, at least the message that I get from it is that it has a whiny attitude. Well, I'm not really sure. you know, and rather than just, damn it, you know, figure it out. You know, if there's something that you don't know and that you're not sure about, investigate it. And, you know, have enough gumption to realize if this is really important to you, you know, investigate it. And then come to some, you know, at some point, you know, if you are investigating and you just, you know, still don't come to anything, then you might just say, okay, well, this is just not clear right now, etc. But the afflictive doubt is just being immobilized by the doubt, and just not being able, and it just stymies you and keeps you from making any progress. But you're not doing anything about it. So that's what afflictive doubt means to me. And then the remedy for that is a subtle investigation, I think. Analysis. What's that? Subtle analysis. Yeah, so there's coarse investigation and subtle analysis, yeah. So, and the distinction between those two is too subtle for me. Even when I asked that and got the answer, I don't get it. But basically, you're analyzing, you're investigating, you know. So you're asking questions. You basically are pursuing your question rather than being immobilized by it. How do you make America great again? We have to film this, because this could be the basis for my candidacy. It's not too late for a write-in, right? So, I mean, what a great question, really, isn't it? And I think that all of us would wish that we had the power to write our own story about this, you know, to basically live in the world of our own creation, in the country of our own creation. We have so, you know, this country still has so much liberty and so much freedom. It really is one of the great leisures and fortunes, or the fortunes, opportunities that we have to be living in a country where we're not, at this point, persecuted for our religious beliefs. But some people are, aren't they? Boy, you know, some people are being killed while they're worshiping now. So, you know, maybe this is not something that we can take for granted any longer. But so what would it be to make America great again? Well, you know, generically, you could say, what would the world be like if everybody lived an ethical life, and basically if we were all obsessed with ridding aggression, hostility, craving, attachment from our minds? What kind of country would we be living in if that were the case? And then compassion just became the realm of the coin of the realm. you know, and all of those things, so those things, basically just living in ethical, basically if everyone were to have a value system in which they valued wisdom more than wealth, and they understood what genuine happiness is, rather than confusing that with hedonic pleasure. So if we lived in a society in which that was the case, I think that it would be the case, given the basic structure of our government, that if society actually lived that way, and that was the foundation of society, our government would naturally come to reflect that. So that would be, I think, would be a great America. You know, it would really be taking advantage of the freedom that is built into our governmental structure. And unfortunately, that freedom also leaves it vulnerable in a lot of ways to exploitations, to being bought out by people with a lot of money who want to write the rules. And now there is just the power of propaganda is so powerful because people's minds are so habituated to conceptuality that it's easier to propagandize people now than it used to be, I think. So anyway, it's an interesting thought. please review the three elements of compassion. Are they attend, empathy, and act? Yes, so they are, and there are these prepositions attached to those also. Attend to, and then feel with. So that's empathy, feeling with someone who you are attending to. And then that naturally leads to act for. Is that correct? Yes. Now the hard part. How does one develop wisdom to act with skillful means? Thanks. So how to develop wisdom? And so wisdom is what we are going to be working on and are working on with Vipassana. So wisdom basically means to see reality truly, rather than to be fooled by the deceptions that we're habituated to. So that's what it means. And so the how does one develop wisdom, and then in parentheses, to act with skillful means? So those are two really different questions. You know, how do you, so wisdom is all, and basically these are the two wings, you could say, of flight, Buddhist flight, the Buddhist bird in flight, actually is wisdom and skillful means. And so wisdom, the way that we go about it here is shamatha in Mahamudra and Dzogchen, is shamatha and vipassana. So first you develop stable, vivid attention so that you have developed the technology, the contemplative technology, to do the contemplative science. And then you use the stable, vivid attention to basically probe the nature in Mahamudra and Dzogchen of the mind itself. And so the wisdom is going to lead you to understand and to have a direct experience of the nature of the mind. And then that is going to lead you to, well, that is going to have a lot of implications. One of the implications is that if you figure it out, your compassion, because remember, as Yangtang Rinpoche pointed out, compassion is one of the bodies of the Buddha. It's the Nirmanakaya. And this is something that you are experiencing as the fundamental aspect of your ordinary awareness right now. So remember, the empty nature is the Dharmakaya. So the essential nature is Dharmakaya of pristine awareness. And then the luminous nature is Sambhogakaya. And then that naturally leads to compassion, which is the Nirmanakaya. And spontaneously. So the skillful means then comes in. So there, basically what you are recognizing is that there are ways that are skillful and ways that are less skillful to help people. And so your wisdom would allow you, especially if you develop shamatha, then you are able to develop what the translator for Trangu Rinpoche called supercognitions. I've never seen that translation before, but basically cities, the super normal powers, or so your clairvoyance, your ability to read people's minds. So imagine if you could read people's minds, that your development of the contemplative technology led you to be able to read people's minds. Then, as I think it was Atisha said, when you develop clairvoyance and you're able to read people's minds, you can do more good in an hour than you could in 1,000 years or something like that. Because you then can really employ skillful means. You know exactly what it is that this person needs. And then we think of skillful means, often as, you know, the lama doing things using skillful means in ways of presenting things, etc., challenging us. But so wisdom, how do we develop wisdom? So how do we develop compassion? Well, again, wisdom plays into that as well. So how is it that we develop? I mentioned yesterday that this ability to act for. So Paul Ekman has his basic way of outlining the process of emotion is that he says that we are a constellation or a cluster of mental processes are constantly scanning the environment for things that are of importance to our well-being, basically opportunities and threats. And so that this then becomes, basically we're just continually scanning the environment. So imagine if you, because of your wisdom, so the Dalai Lama and Paul Ekman both discuss this at great length, that there is a large cognitive component to compassion, meaning that you prepare yourself to act for by kind of imbibing this framework of what the value of that is. And then you see, basically you get teachings, you see it modeled for you by great figures, and you see also how that leads to happiness and that acts of compassion actually are enjoyable for us as well. So all of this goes into this framework that begins to prepare you to act for, even in ambiguous situations where you don't exactly know what's going on, but you're so prepared so that it seems to me what you are doing is because of the wisdom and this framework that you have that is imbuing you now, that you are now scanning the environment for things that will affect well-being, just in general, not just your own, but just well-being of anyone. And if you see something that you can do about it, you're just prepared to do it. And it is that just being prepared is what leads to acts of compassion. And then you, because you are continually attending to and you are successful in attending to, you can't help really but feel with when you see emotional arousal and you're actually attending to it. And then as the Dalai Lama and Paul Ekman said, if you actually are feeling the emotion yourself, the chances are good that you're going to act for. This is a silly question, so feel free to veto. Shouldn't we begin to create some new words for our journey with Mahamudra and Dzogchen? Here's a start. Formtiness. For emptiness form. Cognawareness. Cognition and awareness. Lumptiness. Luminosity and emptiness. Empty appearance. empty appearance. It's gonna go viral. Yeah, well, if you're a translator of Tibetan texts for a great Lama who has a wide readership, you have a great opportunity to change the lexicon. Where can we learn more about gaze? Well, the teachings that emphasize gaze most that I know about are Dzogchen and Mahamudra. And then gaze, so one thing this brings up, something that I forgot to mention about when we were antidotes to excitation and laxity and subtle corrections that are easy to do, that are very effective. And the nice thing about these is that you don't have to interrupt your engagement with the object to do these. It's the gaze. And so this is one reason that you, it's very helpful to meditate. Another reason that it's very helpful to meditate with your eyes open is that you can adjust your gaze based on what your, the degree of clarity that you have at that moment. And so everybody, it's a very universal experience that, and this is, so shamatha, remember, the gaze is lowered because you're trying to reduce distraction generally. And then if you're feeling lax, elevate your gaze. And it doesn't have to be much. What you'll notice is that just a few degrees of raising on towards the horizontal will really brighten things up. Oh, and I don't know if I mentioned, actually, when we were discussing the Mahabrahma Samadhi of Stability, that also the advice is, so your the brilliant light leaves through the Brahmanic aperture at the crown and goes off into space, that you actually elevate your gaze as well and look up. So that is actually going to be beneficial also. So that's one element of gaze. But the place that you really see, that I've seen references to gaze, and I can't say that I've seen reference, well, I don't know anything about it, but it's in Dzogchen in the direct crossing over practices. So gaze becomes important in that, and basically it's these teachings are the ones that you don't get until you're ready for them. And so I'm not ready for them. You know, these are after you are well stabilized in Rigpa. Then you get these teachings about how you progress quickly through the bhumis. And gaze is an important element of that. And it's at that point, so it mentioned that there are some distinctions, subtle distinctions in certain areas between Dzogchen and Mahamudra. So a lot of commentators say that the practices basically for cutting through to pristine awareness are the same in Dzogchen and Mahamudra. Basically, it's shamatha and vipassana. But when you get to Rigpa then, and you're resting in Rigpa, then Dzogchen has its own very unique path. And it involves gaze, and it involves working with a channel that is only known to that practice. It's not found in any other Vajrayana practice, a unique channel. So where can we learn more about gaze? I guess it depends on what kind of gaze you're talking about, you know. But Mahamudra, basically the only references I've seen to it are the gaze for shamatha and the gaze for vipassana. And elevating the gaze for vipassana, basically it's just your sight line, you know, slightly above the horizontal. And then you can also elevate for laxity and excitation. And then the other gaze is to be continued, hopefully. Can you further explain what it means to push your inhalation down into your belly when you do vase breathing? How do you do this? Well, you push down with your, you know, because I'm not an anatomist, I'm sure there, so somebody, a yoga teacher who studied anatomy probably knows that there are, you know, all the names of these muscles around here. And if you look in White Llama, I think I mentioned a couple of these, because Theos Bernard was really a master of Nauli, this practice of Nali. And some of you may were here when 2 years ago when we did our teaching here, and Rima Datta was our yoga teacher, and she's a mistress of Nali. And so she was demonstrating this to us. You know, we had this short yoga period, and so she had us doing Nali, you know, as an essential practice. And so there are the muscles that I recall on the sides that were being used to do that are the rectus something, pectoralis rectus or something. What's that? Oh, okay. But so there are... You know, there's a group of muscles anyway around here that we probably just aren't familiar with because we don't use them, etc. I know that's the way that it feels to me, like I'm just a spastic when I try to do Nali. You know, it's just, well, there's just nothing there. And then you see, well it certainly can be there. So it seems to me, basically, with my primitive experience, you know, the abdomen moves out and in. So what that muscle is, whether it's the diaphragm or whatever, I don't, you know, I'm consult somebody who knows about that, but you're asking me. And so I notice that there is a separate movement. So when you breathe in, by expanding I'll just call it the diaphragm, the abdomen, out like that, gently and fully, then that muscle is kind of engaged in keeping the vase container expanded. And then it feels to me like there is another muscle that is closer to the spine than that feels like it's kind of rolling like Nali, but it just kind of, you know, goes whoot. And you know that there's one muscle that expands, and then it seems like there's another muscle closer to the spine that just kind of pushes down. But all that the texts say about that is just that you gently push down the breath into the bottom of the belly.
Sokhin Rinpoche was here a few years ago, and he described it as if gently, not obviously forcefully, as if you're trying to poop a little bit, you know?
Yeah, I could see that. Okay, so there you have it. So basically, I think, you know, it's just experiment and... It's not, so first of all, know that it's really easy. It's really gentle. And you can't mess up. Can you give your own experiential commentary on a summary of the view, meditation, and conduct? Why are the only two words italicized essential and manifest, for emphasis, I guess. Can you say what the experiential difference is between naturally clear Sambhogakaya and luminous primordial consciousness? So, first of all, what is my experiential commentary on a summary of the view, meditation, and conduct? I'm dazzled by it. You know, basically that's about it. That it seems like it just encompasses everything. And it's just, you know, the view. It's the view by way of meditation. So I don't think that it's important at all that the words are italicized, those two words, because that's a typographical decision that I might have made. I don't think so. It's a typographical decision that Alan probably made in the notes that he handed out. But typically what an editor would italicize, you know, in that way, in a text like that, the first usage of a foreign term. So like, you know, bodhicitta or, you know, a Sanskrit term, something like that. But basically, I don't think there's any, that those two words are more significant than any of the surrounding terms, because they're all very significant. But basically what you're, the point of those is that there are three natures of pristine awareness, primordial consciousness. So, and because there are three bodies of a Buddha. And so the point, I think, is we're talking about Buddha nature. So what is Buddha nature? You know, in what does it mean when these texts say that all of us have Buddha nature? And it's said that a Buddha has two bodies, three bodies, or four bodies, you know, depending on how many bodies you're looking at, but basically a form body, a mind body, you know, and then, you know, an emanation body. So those are three standard ones. So how, you know, we can think of these three bodies of a Buddha as we can reify them as something that only a Buddha could have. You have to, you know, develop, you have to, that only Shakyamuni has these three bodies. And that, you know, these are something that I can't even imagine, these three bodies of a Buddha. So how interesting to think that these three bodies of a Buddha are actually what is my Buddha nature. When they tell us that every sentient being, not just every human being, but every sentient being has Buddha nature, what does that mean? And how does that relate to what is called, what in Mahamudra is called ordinary mind? Every ordinary moment of awareness. Well, it means that every ordinary awareness, every moment of awareness, is empty. It has its essential nature is emptiness. And that essential nature of emptiness of every ordinary moment of perception or awareness is Dharmakaya. That is the Buddha body of Dharmakaya. And then how is it that emptiness, so is emptiness nothingness? Is it, does that mean, yeah, what does that emptiness mean? What does Dharmakaya mean? Is there a consciousness? So what is the consciousness part of primordial consciousness, pristine awareness, Rigpa, all synonymous? What is the consciousness element? Well, that is called the manifest nature. And then Yangtang Rinpoche said that the manifest nature of Dharmakaya is luminosity. And the empty nature of luminosity, or the essential nature of luminosity of Sambhogakaya, is emptiness or Dharmakaya. And that these two are non-dual. They are unity. They are a unity. And this is the so helpful when he pointed this out. He said there is no other perceiver of this non-dual union of luminosity and emptiness. Awareness is self-aware. It's not as if they're, so who is it when we're doing our meditation, you know, who is it that is aware of the luminosity, if we are highlighting that? Who is it that is creating the intention? Who is it that is observing emptiness? The mind is, so awareness is self-aware. You don't have to have this infinite regression of another awareness watching that awareness, another this awareness watching that, you know, in a big hall of mirrors. It is just the non-dual union of luminosity and emptiness is self-aware. And then the third body of the Buddha is Nirmanakaya, which is spontaneous emanation. And then that one is called the pervasive nature, or all pervasive nature, but pervasive nature. And that then is said to be compassion. So compassion is the pervasive nature, which leads to spontaneous emanation. And then all of those are already our birthright, just obscured right now. It's there to be discovered. As soon as we cut through our obsession with being only the body, speech, and mind of a sentient being. Because that, what is the difference between a Buddha and a sentient being? Dzogchen says, the difference is that a Buddha knows who they are. And a sentient being is confused about that. There is a perspective from which it is true that we are sentient beings. We have mental afflictions. We have karma created by mental afflictions that produces causes and conditions. And, you know, our bodies grow old and die. It's true from one perspective that we are sentient beings. The question is that the whole truth and nothing but the truth? Or is there a greater truth that actually encompasses the lower truth, doesn't negate it, but it is a greater truth? And so that's what Dzogchen is leading us to, is to discover the whole truth. And the whole truth is that, yes, as long as we identify with being the body, speech, and mind of a sentient being, then that is true. That's who we are. But we don't have to fabricate a mind. We don't have to, that is enlightened. We don't have to fabricate the three bodies of a Buddha. You know, that they are not here right now as part of our awareness. They are there just waiting to be discovered, waiting to be uncovered, unobscured. In our morning prayers, there is the line, I rejoice without convergence or divergence. What does this mean? In the commentary of Lama Tarchin, it says that basically that means without conceptuality, without bringing the mind together within conceptuality or dispersing it with conceptuality. So that's what I take that. I haven't thought much more about that. So without, you know, convergence or divergence, whenever you see that kind of dichotomy, so I guess this is one way that would make sense. These dichotomies of convergence, divergence, beginning and ending, existence and non-existence, these are called the conceptual extremes. And so they're, one doesn't exist without the other. It doesn't make sense to talk about convergence without divergence, or existence without non-existence, coming without going, starting without stopping. You know, so they exist only because they're as conceptual categories. And then when we are resting in Rigpa, it is beyond all conceptual extremes, meaning that conceptions just don't compute. And the one that, and one in, or is it one or many, is it another one that can really, people get hung up on about that one. Is primordial consciousness one big mind, or is, do all Buddhas have their own minds, etc. Does, and then, so if it exists, does it exist, is that the one thing then that that is self-existent? Does not compute. Existence and non-existence. It's just beyond all conceptual categories. So I think that's what it's referring to in the prayers, is basically it's just beyond conceptuality. At work, which is 8 to 10 hours a day, we are paid to use our mind to evaluate, conceptualize, etc. How do we practice non-conceptualization in this context? Well, recognize, first of all, that it is possible to have a non-conceptual view of the conceptual mind at work, as it's working. So I think that's the first thing, to recognize that it is possible. And then, you know, pick your opportunities. Because there are times, so basically, there are times when it's probably going to be more beneficial to have a non-conceptual view of the conceptual mind at work than others. So you might start off with doing triage. And so, for instance, if you're doing a spreadsheet, for instance, is it necessary to have a non-conceptual view to add up a sum of figures or something to get the right answer anyway? You know, probably not. I don't think so. But if you are having a difficult conversation with somebody, and you are recognizing that you're feeling mentally afflicted, and that you have a habit of seeing this person in a particular way, then I think it would be very beneficial to be able to bring a non-conceptual view to watch your conceptualizing mind as it's operating. And you wouldn't even attempt to do that if you didn't know it was possible. So I would say, basically, it depends on what the task is that you're doing. And so, for instance, if you're doing creative work, also, it could be extremely beneficial. I think for writing, you know, I think it's very beneficial. Anything that you might want to, that is, bring to step out of old habits of perception, I think it would be very beneficial. Something like that. But I'm sure that there is a lot more that could be said about that I just isn't coming to mind, or that I don't have a clue about. What is the antidote for attachment to form of the opposite sex? What is the antidote for attachment to the construct one has to be their significant other or lover? So it depends on whether you are a monk, a Theravadan monk, a Mahayana monk, probably, a Vajrayana practitioner, a Dzogchenpa, a Mahamudran, I think. So if you are a Theravadan monk, one of the things that you would do as an antidote to attachment to the form of the opposite sex is that you would peel away their skin in visualization and just see all of the organs underneath the skin and then think, well, if it's the form that I'm so interested in, maybe I could just take the skin home with me and, you know, where's that happy birthday balloon? You know, you basically inflate it. You know, something like that. So that's the approach of Theravadins is revulsion, basically. But, you know, what an antidote that is. Who wants to have an absence of beauty in their lives? And human form is beautiful, isn't it? I mean, we just, men and women respond to beautiful others, you know, and it's a very powerful, pleasant experience. So, you know, who wants to live in a place without natural beauty, you know, especially as call it spiritual practice, you know, it doesn't make sense to me. So what is the antidote for attachment to form of the opposite sex? I'm probably not a good person to ask about that. No, I probably am. I'm old enough. I'm not as obsessed as I used to be. I know that. Let's go to this next one. What is the antidote for attachment to the construct one has to be their significant other? So what is attachment mean anyway? So let's figure out what that means, first of all. So attachment means basically that you are, first of all, reifying the object of your attachment, meaning that you are seeing it as self-existent. And the second element is that you are exaggerating it. So you are seeing only its positive qualities, and you then see that as being true, inherently existent, true. This person is totally 100% beautiful, and they are totally, attachment would say, because they are, because it's attachment, they are a cause of my happiness. And so I then become attached to the external form as the cause of my happiness. And the attachment then involves the clinging, either to get something that you don't have or to keep something that you do have, because your happiness depends on it. So if you are deluded enough to think that your happiness depends on being the significant other of this person, then the antidote to that would be wisdom, right? You see that this person, that, and it is impossible for an external thing to be a cause of happiness. It's just impossible, because happiness is a state of mind, a mental state. So how could a physical thing be a cause of happiness? Well, we're deluded, we reify it, we become attached to it. And so wisdom would be the antidote to attachment. And especially in thinking that I need to be in this relationship is the cause of my happiness, and my happiness depends on this relationship. And then loving kindness would be, I think, another antidote, in the sense that when we are talking about attachment in relationships, we're always talking about my happiness. And so if you are interested in any, and you truly love the other person, what you are concerned about with is their happiness. And how is it that I can be a cause of your happiness? I am wishing you to be happy, genuinely happy, not just to have hedonic pleasure, temporary hedonic pleasures. But that can be, you know, nothing wrong with those in themselves either. You don't have to be an ascetic. The Buddha tried that. It's just don't be obsessed and think that these things are a cause of happiness. And then the human form, what is the antidote to being obsessed with the human form? Yeah. I think that's it, you know. Now, I think it's wisdom again, you know. It's still the same thing. You have to see that the obsession or the attachment with the human form is always because what is attachment? It is a mental affliction, right? So every mental affliction depends on two things: reification and exaggeration. So eliminate those two things and you eliminate the attachment. An unfindable mind seems to lend itself to the possibility of simulation theory. How do you or Alan refute this theory? That's one you had better ask Alan. Because I don't know what simulation theory is. It's probably artificial intelligence, I would guess. But Alan believes that he has a ironclad refutation of the most sophisticated of the most current materialist explanations of consciousness that is proposed by Christoph Koch, which I can't remember the name of that theory. But so simulation, you know, I mean, if you want a real answer to your real question, otherwise I would have to just make something up. Are pointing out instructions given during this retreat? What do you think? So it would depend on what you think of as pointing out instructions. So it can mean a couple of different things. So for instance, these pith instructions of Yangtang Rinpoche, would you say that is pointing out the nature of mind? I would say very clearly and experientially. I mean, it's just kind of leading you by the hand and taking you step by step. So I would say that in that sense, I read pointing out instructions of Yangtang Rinpoche. So that I would say when we get to the Vipassana, when we have gotten to the Vipassana portion of the retreat rather than the Shamatha portion, pointing out refers to pointing out the nature of mind, so that when I have mentioned to you the nature of awareness is luminosity or luminous cognizance, luminous hyphen cognizance. That's pointing out. You know, again, I'm not pointing out, but I am giving you the pointing out instructions of Trangu Rinpoche, of the Ninth Karmapa, etc., because they're you know, pointing you directly to the nature of mind. So in that sense, I would say that, yes, I have conveyed or done the best that I possibly can anyway without screwing it up, the pointing out instructions of people who really know what they're talking about. And so in that sense, I think you could say yes. And so you might have asked this question before Yangtang Rinpoche's soliloquy. But the other way that pointing out instructions is often understood is as what in the Mahamudra tradition is technically called essence Mahamudra. And so that is where you go to a great lama who you have tremendous confidence and devotion for, in and for, and who has a direct experience of Mahamudra, and you bring all of the right conditions and the right aspiration, and then everything clicks, and then you get the essence Mahamudra transmission. And so, you know, there are lamas around who can have the capacity to do that. Like, I have confidence Trangu Rinpoche is one of those lamas. Kenshin Saltram Gyamso is another one of those. I had studied with him briefly 10 years ago. You know, there are Dzogchen Mahamudra lamas that can do mind-to-mind transmission like that. And if the conditions are right, then people can get this blast of basically the lama's realization, kind of opening our awareness of our own condition, basically, because he's not giving us something we don't already have. He's just temporarily removing the veils. So that experience is sometimes also called pointing out instruction, that you're getting that kind of transmission from a lama. And interestingly, Trangu Rinpoche said that so many people are obsessed with that kind of pointing out, that they want the big transmission, you know, and just give it to me, lama. pour it into me. And he says, really? I think it's a lot more important to take the gradual approach of Mahamudra and develop it step by step on your own, because he said almost always the big flash of insight that you get from a lama is temporary. And the great temptation then is to cling to it, to grasp to it. And an even greater temptation is to identify with it and say, now, I am resting in Mahamudra. Right? Now that becomes your reference point. I am a person who got the transmission. I don't know if anybody else did there. I don't think so. So here's a real-world, off-cushion, post-meditation challenge. Uh-oh, your website is something. Something customer service is outsourced to India. My website? Every sentence you say is repeated back with a somewhat different meaning. Of course, you're something on time. Anger are Isis. What is a good technique to apply in this case to maintain equilibrium and remain patient? How to muster compassion? I'd better reread this. So, a real world off cushion post meditation challenge. Your website is non, what is that word? Non? Does whoever wrote this want to weigh in on this? Because now I'm feeling... Okay, it's true that I didn't do a damn thing to my website for a year. It is true. And Mary Kay mentioned that to me. And so the day before I came here, I actually posted information about the retreat in Salt Spring Island. But that was not outsourced to India. I did it. So what does that mean? Your website is not, is, I think that says non, non. What?
It's for me.
Okay.
And it was my website, it was non-functional, I
wrote. Oh, your website you're talking about generically, one's website. Oh, okay. Well, I understand why your website would be non-functional. Yeah. Okay, so one's website is non-customer service is non-functional, right? Something like that? It's not working.
It doesn't load.
Oh, it won't load when...
Right. The question is about dealing with people who are probably got pretty miserable lives. And it's hard to be patient with their script.
So, but the question is, anger arises. So, I see that anger us. It really is pretty good handwriting, you know. But there's no space between the R and the A. That threw me. You know, I'm kind of a literalist, I guess. Okay, so a real-world situation arises. Basically, you lose patience with something arises that you become impatient with. Anger arises. And what is a good technique to apply in this case to maintain equilibrium and remain patient? How to muster compassion? First of all, breathe. Take 3 deep breaths. Focus on the exhalation. So you're going to be relaxing there. And then bring awareness. So all of the awareness that you are practicing on the cushion, bring that to bring your mind to the present moment. And what this is going to do then, because you're talking about an emotional response. And so what Paul Ekman describes is that there is a, basically, when we have an emotion that is aroused by something in our emotional alert database, meaning, and so something, it often is something that can trigger an emotion is probably something that is totally unrelated to what put the emotion or that is really relevant to the situation. But something can trigger something in your emotional alert database that is not really present right now. You know, and it could be, and very commonly Paul Ekman says, that the thing in the emotional alert database was actually put there even before you learn language. That's why it can be really difficult to describe in words what you're feeling. And why, so he describes this things that go into the emotional alert database as a one-way permeable membrane. So just recognizing that it's like my Gmail account. You know, when I go to Google, all of the archive is there. Nothing is deleted. You know, it's just all the old stuff is there. And so if you recognize that, so then the process that he describes is that once a emotion is stimulated by something that comes out of basically stimulated by a notice from the emotional alert database, the emotion and this is the problem with emotion, is that it is intended to be fast rather than accurate. So because an instantaneous response and having to apologize later could save your life. You know, you get out of the way of the charging rhino or something, you know, because of a fear response. So this is the way that the seven basic emotions work in Paul Ekman's evolutionary scheme. He says that then when an emotion is, because of that, the speed of it, actually, and the way Daniel Goleman actually describes this really well, the brain circuitry that is involved in this, and the midbrain and brainstem, etc., that basically it happens before precognition. So the cognitive route, thinking about a response, actually is very, very slow. And the emotional response is intended to be quick. And so what happens with the speed, the way that you get the speed, is that there are what he calls affect programs. So basically, this is a programmed response. Whenever this emotion arises, it sets in motion. This is why it's called emotion. It sets in motion a script of responses that are automatic. You don't think about them. So there are somatic responses. So for anger, your heart rate is going to speed up. Blood is going to flow to your hands. For fear, blood is going to flow to your limbs, especially your legs, etc. So, and then there are also programmed thoughts that are going to arise. But you don't have to think any of it because it's happening faster than cognition can operate. So this is the challenge of anger, for instance, when it arises. And so Paul Ekman, there's another problem as well. So there is a gap, a very brief gap between what Paul Ekman calls the spark and the flame. So the spark would be the stimulus setting off the affective program. And then the flame would be all of the behaviors that arise, you're lashing out at the object of your, and so the theme of anger, you nailed it. It's somebody is placing an obstacle in my path. So this is what the theme of anger is in Ekman's scheme. And so when that theme arises, the whole goal of practicing awareness with emotions in cultivating emotional balance is we use all of the meditation skills that we have been doing, because Alan contributed that part of the program to it, to bringing awareness to this brief gap between the spark and the flame. And so if we can bring awareness then to, and actually be, and are aware that an emotion actually is arising Because at this point, still the emotion is unconscious. We're not even aware of it unless we practice bringing awareness to our emotional lives and can and really bring awareness to this gap. And as soon as we become aware of the presence of an emotion, then we can begin to bring choice to it. And especially if you have, again, preloaded a predisposition about how you respond to emotional stimulation in general, in that you value constructive rather than destructive emotional expression. And so basically then you would have a choice when you become aware of an emotion in that gap of either not expressing the emotion or choosing to express it constructively rather than following a destructive habitual behavior pattern. So that would be basically awareness, recognizing that all of this is happening as a sequence of moments, and that one of those moments is the gap between the spark and the flame, and can you bring awareness to that? Now, the other challenge about our emotional lives is that what Paul Ekman calls the refractory period. And this is a cognitive deficit. So it's not an attention deficit, but it's a cognitive deficit, meaning that we become stupid. We don't have access to large sections of our mind and our brain, because the way that things are working at that moment is that the only memories that you have access to during that period of the refractory period are memories that confirm and enhance the emotion. And so this person, every goddamn experience that I've had with these Indians in customer service has been horrible, you know, and that's all you can remember is that. And then, you know, it just inflames that. So recognize that there is, you basically only have half a mind when you are emotionally aroused. So that leads then to the basic advice about how to deal with emotional arousal. So as basically it's an elaboration of what a lama said, which is don't repress it, but don't act on it. So what did Shantideva say about mental afflictions? Become a stick of wood, be a bump on a log. So the reason for that is that you realize that you only have half a mind at that point, and that you're bound to make a mistake, you know, and then hopefully it's not too long, but before the refractory period is over, it could be a fraction of a second. It could be basically if you're re-triggering the emotion, and that largely happens through rumination, that you're just dwelling, repeating this, and he's such a sucker, I hate that bastard, you know, that internal dialogue, you're just re-triggering the emotion over and over and over again. And so you are just re-triggering the refractory period as well. So awareness, so basically I think, honestly, knowing the process of emotion is very, very helpful as a part of the antidote, because it helps to create the framework for being a stick of wood as your response, recognizing I'm angry. And whenever you are angry, boy, it's hard to imagine a real scenario where it's going to be really beneficial to act at that moment. You know, if you're truly angry, and Ekman and His Holiness the Dalai Lama had discussions about that, you know, and then, you know, basically I think they ended up with that distinction between wrath and anger, you know, that that anger is deluded, you know, and is a mental affliction. And wrath could be that you're feeling the arousal and you sense the immediate need to do something, and you do it with full awareness. So at that point, the mind of wisdom, non-conceptuality, is watching the conceptual mind use skillful means to get your point across, to intervene in some situation of injustice, for instance, or whatever, to save somebody's life. But that is hot on the outside, cool on the inside. So I hope that's helpful. Glad you weren't talking about my website, because then I would feel obligated to go home and do something about it. But that really had me worried that something about my website was going to India. Well, let's go to bed. What a great virtue you have created today. Trying to cultivate wisdom. What could be better? So this wisdom is a virtue that is going to ripen. Rather than let it ripen as some temporary pleasure, dedicate the virtue that you have created today, this great mass of virtue, to the greatest possible benefit. May it benefit all beings, and may it benefit them in the ultimate way, so that they actually know the distinction between temporary pleasure and genuine happiness, that they find a path for cultivating genuine happiness, that they find guides to lead them along that path. And that this virtue ripens in the greatest possible way that I become enlightened, so that I can lead others to enlightenment as well, to be that guide for others. May it be so because of the goodness I have done today.